The time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next, People Rise Up. Welcome to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we are going to have part four of It Is Happening Here, a year-long series that is investigating 14 common characteristics of modern fascist states and the extent to which the United States government and society exemplifies each of those characteristics or not. Today, we're going to be looking at characteristic number four, which is supremacy of the military and avid militarism. My guests this morning are Chalmers Johnson, author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, as well as Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, and many, many other books on Japanese and Far East Asian affairs. He's president of the Japanese Policy Research Institute. And welcome to you, Chalmers.
Good morning.
And also on the line, we have Gregory Foster. He is a civilian professor at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, which is part of the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, let's just start out here. I'm going to start out here with a couple questions here for Chalmers, Gregory, but I'll be back to you in just a few minutes here.
Okay.
Chalmers, you dedicate a chunk of The Sorrows of Empire to looking at the issue specifically of militarism as opposed to talking about the military per se. Can you just quickly draw the distinction between the military and militarism?
Well, the military is has a function of defending the country, and that no one doubts for a moment that there is the need under certain circumstances to defend the country if we are victims of foreign aggression, the need to raise a citizen army, and things of this sort. Militarism refers to a way of life, to vested interests in life in the military, to, above all, a way of making a living. That is one of the most important manifestations of militarism in the United States today, is the so-called military-industrial complex, and the remarkable degree to which it has penetrated into our society. I offer just one small bit of evidence. Every time the Secretary of Defense proposes closing no longer needed domestic military bases, seemingly a perfectly logical thing to do, one community after another across America erupts in outrage. How dare you close our base? That we need the jobs. Dependent. Our community is dependent upon this. That sort of thing. This is a sign of militarism. So it's in that sense, I think that we're talking about the world of 737 American military bases located in other people's countries. That's not to mention the several thousand domestically. 737 is the official Pentagon count in the base structure report. It actually leaves out quite a few. Certainly all the espionage bases and those that are disguised in one way or another, often for political reasons. That's, I think, a sign of militarism, of the degree to which we have come to embrace the military as a way of life, as an important institution in our society. Yet at the same time, it's more or less beyond democratic restraints. The 40% of the defense budget is black, has been for years now. That is, it's secret. Even members of Congress who might want to do effective oversight can't often obtain access to it, particularly for some projects. It's things like that that we're referring to.
Now, in The Sorrows of Empire, you have two chapters specifically about militarism, kind of the roots and origins of American militarism and then the institutions.
Yes.
In the roots section, you list three key indicators of militarism, and you say that they all basically were spawned after World War II. They are the emergence of a professional military class.
Yes.
The preponderance of military officers and arms industry representatives in high government positions,
mm-hmm.
and a devotion to policies in which military preparedness becomes the highest priority of the state.
Yes.
Now, do you see each of those kind of happening simultaneously post-World War II, or was there, you know, did the emergence of a professional military class obviously would have to come first before a preponderance of military officers could get into high government positions?
No, it obviously took a long time to develop. What we're talking about is the fact that the United States has been either prepared for or engaged in war since 1941 to the present. And to discuss the effects of such a development over such a long period of time, one needs go no further than the primary author of the Constitution, James Madison, who devoted a great deal of attention to the effect of war on the state and the degree to which it inevitably undercuts the attempt to create a balance of power within the government, that it moves power toward the executive branch. It raises taxes, it centralizes the economy, it just more or less makes the structure bestowed by the Founding Fathers in the Constitution unworkable. Something very much like that has happened today. That's what I'm referring to here. But it certainly takes a long period of time to develop it. After all, it was back in Eisenhower's farewell address in 1961 that he both invented the phrase military-industrial complex and warned us about unauthorized power in the society and the degree to which it was undercutting the structure of our government.
Well, and in his farewell address, President George Washington, in
yes.
September of 1796, said, quote, overgrown military establishments are under any form of government inauspicious to liberty and are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty.
Yes. Now, by Republican, he means the Republic as a structure of government, not party, of course.
Right,
yes,
right.
That's famous. I mean, it's remember that Washington's farewell address is read every year in the American Congress. Too bad no one pays any attention to it anymore.
Now, Gregory Foster, you have a military background, as far as I can tell from your biography. You graduated from West Point. You served as an infantry company commander in Vietnam. You have taught at the National Defense University for some time, and you've had you have a degree in a doctorate in public administration from the George Washington University. First, anything you would like to add or contrast to what Chalmers has said on my first couple questions?
No, I agree wholeheartedly with what he has said over time, very perceptibly and persuasively. I guess I would say that I think militarism not only is a way of life, it's a state of mind. And I think that's a very important point to accentuate in drawing this picture of our society and certainly our organs of government as having become perhaps more militaristic.
Now, if I may ask, when is it you graduated from West Point?
I graduated in 1969.
Okay. So this gives me a little bit of frame of reference in your lifespan in the military. Have you observed growing militarism among your peers within the military? I guess in the Army, correct?
I was in the Army. I have been a civilian for quite some time. I've been on the faculty here at the National Defense University for some two decades. I guess it's probably most useful to perhaps offer my observations on what I've seen among the professional military class and the types of students we get here. Our students at the National Defense University houses two of the five colleges that collectively constitute the senior level of the military's professional schooling system. And I would say at the risk of, these folks are lieutenant colonels and colonels or Navy officers of comparable grade, as well as senior federal civil servants. And I think it's fair to say at the risk of overgeneralizing that especially in the during the period now in which we are truly a volunteer military, that I have sensed more of a kind of a circling of the wagons, if you will, intellectually or mentally, and a tendency, as open as the institution is, a tendency nonetheless, I think, to become a bit alienated from the rest of society. And I think that's a matter of considerable concern to me.
Now, about a week or so back, you had a piece published in the Baltimore Sun that was redistributed around. It's called The Long War Posture.
Right.
And this references the latest name change in the Bush administration's kind of open-ended and ambiguous war that will last my lifetime and could sprout up anywhere at any point, according to the rhetoric over the past few years.
Right.
A few paragraphs in, you write of the rhetoric regarding the long war from the Bush administration, quote, "The intent of the message is to dull our senses, to dampen our expectations, to thereby deaden the critical dissenting forces of democracy that produce political turbulence and impede autocratic license." Why
right.
did you write this piece, and what is it that you see specifically about what the administration is saying about the long war that caused you to say this?
Well, I think that labeling this set of activities that our military is engaged in now as a long war is basically a bit of semantic or rhetorical ledger domain to kind of set us up for the long haul and to basically convince us that what we're up to now in fighting this so-called global war on terrorism is something that inevitably will endure perhaps into perpetuity, as perhaps overstated as that is. And I'm concerned that, in fact, what is happening is that we are allowing ourselves, we citizens are allowing ourselves to be set up for a perpetual state of war in which the presidency becomes ever more an imperial presidency, and Congress uses this as an excuse to continue to self-marginalize itself, and the public generally becomes benumbed to this as the norm. And is afraid to speak out for fear of being characterized as unpatriotic or seditious or what have you.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. My guests are Gregory Foster speaking just there. He is a professor at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, part of the National Defense University, and author of a piece in the Baltimore Sun last week called The Long War Posture. And we're also joined by Chalmers Johnson, author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. More information about this show will be available at the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. And we are doing part four today of a series running the course of this year. It is happening here, looking at characteristics of modern fascist states and the extent to which the U.S. government and society exemplify them. And we're talking about characteristic number four, supremacy of the military and avid militarism. I want to take something that you just said, Greg Foster, and relay it to something in Chalmers Johnson's book that I was going to refer to later, but it seems too perfect not to bring it up now. It's the quote that closes Chapter 2, The Roots of American Militarism, and it's from a book published in 1967, and the quote goes, "Having grown accustomed to our empire and having found it pleasing, we have come to take its institutions and its assumptions for granted. Indeed, this is the mark of a convinced imperial power. Its advocates never questioned the virtues of empire, although they may dispute the way in which it is administered. And they do not for a moment doubt that it is in the best interests of those over whom it rules." And I think we can see that very clearly nowadays, especially as the military has shifted its role more and more, not out of the military sphere, but more and more into the civilian sphere, whether it's engaging in domestic policing actions, doing things that the CIA used to do, the FBI used to do, now Department of Homeland Security, interfering in diplomacy that the Department of State is engaged in, and then there's issues of intelligence. Chalmers,
yes.
Do you see the trend of what I'll term Pentagon creep kind of holding course? Do you see it expanding more rapidly? Is this trend no longer relevant?
Oh, I think there's no question that the diffusion of military influence throughout the society continues and goes ahead. Let's just also be candid about it. There are a great many Americans who believe that the military is one of the few institutions in our society that actually works. Say, on an issue like racial integration, the military has managed to bring that off quite spectacularly in ways that it hasn't necessarily happened in other parts of our society. But there's, I think, also this expansion of military influence in many ways is dangerous. It's precisely the point I think that Mr. Foster was raising earlier. Throughout our history, the idea of service in the armed forces was an obligation of citizenship. We raised armies for purposes of national security. This had, whatever you think of the draft, this nonetheless had an important influence on suppressing militarism. People were in the armed forces because they had to be there. It was a duty required of them. It was the reason I was in the Navy in the Korean War. You became interested in whether the generals knew what they were doing, whether the war made any sense, things of this sort. Since 1973, service in the armed forces is not an obligation of citizenship. It's a career choice. As we know, it is, until the Iraq War, one being taken by many Americans facing dead ends of one kind or another. That's why until the decline in getting African Americans in the armed forces because of the Iraq War, that they were twice as well represented in the armed forces as in the society as a whole. Why 50% of the women in the armed forces come from national minorities of one sort or another. But that this subtly alters the understanding of the military, that, as I say, it is then a way of life, and it does, over time, turn into a mindset. and that I think the expansion, but let me say there's also a check on the expansion of the military today in that a great many people in the military are beginning to wonder, what are we doing? General Zinni, former Marine Corps four-star general, CENTCOM commander, has commented, what on earth was the Pentagon doing running the attempts to recreate civil society in Iraq? That they're not well qualified for it, they weren't prepared for it, they don't know what they're doing. Why on earth should we have let Rumsfeld cut out people in our government that do have at least some claim to professional knowledge in this area? And we see this growing increasingly, that there are people within the military that have doubts about where they're going. One of the things I think that also serves here as an important background to these issues of militarism was the virtual discrediting of the military as a result of the Vietnam War and the painful attempts by some senior figures in the armed forces to rebuild, particularly the Army, after the Vietnam War, and the feeling that they got it more or less back up to professional levels at the time of the first Persian Gulf War. Today, you can't help but fear that they're facing an even greater discrediting of the military when maybe 20,000 insurgents in Iraq can bring more or less to a halt the effectiveness of 135,000 heavily armed, heavily trained American troops. There's something very, very badly wrong here, and that's just waiting to erupt in public discourse at some point.
Greg Foster, I'm curious about your impression of the U.S. military in that way post-Vietnam, having served there yourself.
Well, I think, as Chalmers Johnson points out, there was a serious discrediting of the military in the immediate aftermath of that experience, and in fact, there was a kind of a crisis of professionalism within the military, that the military set about rather seriously to try to rectify. I think it has succeeded in making itself an effective professional force, but by the same token, it has become further sedimented, if I may use that term, in its ways. The rhetoric we hear about defense transformation, I think, is almost entirely rhetoric. On the one hand, I want to say the military is really not fundamentally changing what it does and how it goes about doing things, even though it is forced to undertake peacekeeping and nation building and humanitarian assistance type tasks. It still considers itself a war fighting military, and the professional members of the institution constantly underscore that. And I think that that has continuing counterproductive effects. This is a military, I would argue, that wants to continue to be a war-fighting military and not get dragged into the sorts of things it really ought to be doing and doing well, like peacekeeping and nation-building and humanitarian assistance, things that require a repertoire of skills and a degree of training and, in fact, a state of mind that are quite unlike what is required for war fighting. On the other hand, at the same time, I am seriously concerned about the breakdowns of these in these traditional demarcations between military and police and military and intelligence activities. I think to the extent that those barriers or those boundaries continue to be fuzzified or obscured, it places the very cherished democratic precept of civilian control of the military in jeopardy. I think the military, largely because it is highly trusted by the American public, at least according to annual opinion polls conducted by Gallup, I think the public tend not to question the expansion of military activities into these other areas, and that's concerns me greatly. At the risk of running on, I would point out a rather famous passage by Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 25, in which he said, "As far as an army may be considered as a dangerous weapon of power, it had better be in those hands of which the people are most likely to be jealous than in those of which they are least likely to be jealous. For it is a truth which the experience of ages has attested that the people are always most in danger when the means of injuring their rights are in the possession of those of whom they entertain the least suspicion." That is a powerful statement of enduring relevance that I think should command our attention right now.
Now, we've got about 3 or so minutes left here, and I want to touch on a topic that definitely deserves mention, but more than 3 minutes, and that's the issue of priority for the military and related agencies and efforts in federal spending versus, say, basic needs of humans and the biological support systems on which we depend. There's been a tremendous upswing in military spending in the Bush administration, and I think it's in the book, Chalmers, that you have a chart that shows that basically in the past 60 years, federal defense spending has never dipped below, well, I think it's like $285 billion a year. It's just about $300 billion. Can you tell us just a little bit about the impact on prioritizing military spending over domestic needs?
Well, quickly, one must understand that the military budget combined, they include quite a few things, is the largest discretionary item in the federal budget. Once you start putting it all together, the United States clearly spends more on military-related affairs than all the rest of the nations on Earth. It's very hard to get the numbers correctly, by the way. There is the annual appropriation today, about $435 billion, for the Department of Defense. That's at the same time, there's still another military budget, military facilities. Then there's $18 billion in the Department of Energy for nuclear energy. There is a somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 billion in Veterans Affairs to pay for the remarkably number of disabled servicemen that we have at the present time. The number comes out somewhere around $750 billion. What that adds up to is bankruptcy. We can't afford it. In fact, the truth of the matter is, as we go ahead today, we're not paying it. We're putting it on the tab. We're borrowing the money from saving societies in China and Japan and places like that, who ship capital to our country in order to finance these expenditures. It is a very dangerous course, and it could certainly alter radically the prospects for the United States whenever and if it catches up with us in a hard manner. But there's no question that military spending is more or less out of control.
Greg Foster, 30 seconds if you'd like to add anything.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think what we ultimately want and need is a military that is not merely militarily effective, but one that is strategically effective, and a military that spends an inordinate amount of money on what I consider to be a gluttonous defense budget at the expense of other critical national strategic priorities, I think is at a minimum wrong-headed, and one could even argue an immoral act.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and we'll let people decide for that on their own. You've been listening to People Rise Up this morning, looking at supremacy of the military and avid militarism as a characteristic of a fascist state. My guests have been Gregory Foster. He's a professor at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces at the National Defense University, and Chalmers Johnson, author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Thank you both very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And more information about this topic will be available at the People Rise Up website at www.kboo.fm. If you have any comments or questions, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. I will be off next week, back on the 17th. Thank you very much for listening to the program. Coming up next, Per Feigering speaks with Gerard Ungerman, whose film The Oil Factor looks at the human cost and geostrategic picture of the war on terror. At 11 on Democracy Now!, hear about the case of Palestinian professor and activist Sami Al-Aryan, who was recently sentenced to another year and a half in prison. You can also hear the comments of Stephen Colbert, host of The Colbert Report, who repeatedly mocked George W. Bush and the press at a White House correspondents' dinner Saturday night. Tomorrow morning at 9:30, tune in for a special election program featuring the candidates for Oregon State Representative in District 46, which includes parts of southeast and northeast Portland surrounding Mount Tabor. Stay tuned for Per Feigering.